Welcome to Day 2 Cloud. On this episode, we are going to be talking to Brett Johnson about building a private cloud and who would do such an incredibly foolish and dangerous thing. We had a really good conversation about the more practical aspects of doing that, especially when it comes to creating policies and actually designing something before you buy a bunch of hardware. What stuck out to you in the conversation, Ethan?
Well, sure, we did talk about design stuff and all of that, but the thing that we spent additional time on was tied to things like communication and policy. In other words, delivering a private cloud to your organization is much like any other IT project that we've ever done. It comes back in the end to dealing with the humans and making sure you understand what these humans need and then building the system that's going to deliver it to them. And Brett really drove that point home for me, Ned.
Yeah, that solid summary. You have to deal with icky humans every once in a while, and this is one of those occasions. So sit back and enjoy this episode with Brett Johnson. Welcome to the show, Brett Johnson. Why don't you first tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and what you do?
I work as a consultant for VMware, and a lot of the work I do is around helping customers build internal cloud solutions and internal automation solutions. So outside of that, it's just a lot of dabbling in pretty much anything that I find interesting.
Excellent. A generalist just like me. I completely understand that. So, I mean, you mentioned internal cloud, and I didn't think that was a thing. As far as I'm aware, everybody moved to the public cloud about 2 years ago, and this internal cloud thing, we got rid of it, right? That's what happened?
I guess it depends on the analyst firm that you're reading. Yeah, totally.
fair enough. Well, yeah, when I think about building an internal cloud, that's a pretty daunting prospect. It's not just simply slapping in virtualization. I imagine there's some layers in there. Could you sort of break down for us what the difference is between running a private cloud versus just having, you know, VMware deployed in your environment?
I'll try to keep all this as agnostic as I can from vendors. With private cloud, you could just, you know, say that it's just putting a self-service portal in front of it, but there's a bit more behind that. We've got things now to consider about what about the cost modeling. If people are building it themselves, how do we, you know, make sure they're billed in, especially in larger organizations where they might be more diligent on billing per project or business group or business unit. So there's a whole billing aspect, which is quite a hard one to work through. And infrastructure's been offered as a service for a long time. If you've got an infrastructure platform and people can consume it, you'd kind of say that that's a service, but it's never really thought of that way, which is one of the big changes is, if it's a service and people can consume it them they want, then we come into questions around how do we monitor and manage capacity while giving more controls to the teams who, you know, usually to do even a little thing would need a change request or some sort of work order. And now they can just click a form and that whole process upends a lot of, you know, a lot of the standard operations.
Yeah. You brought up two key things there that it, you know, it's more than just that service portal. I mean, yeah, you can slap self-service onto anything, but then you have to also put the controls in there from a billing perspective. How are you going to do chargeback or showback? And I guess the other thing is like capacity. When you think of the public cloud, it's infinite pools of resources, right? But the private cloud is probably going to be like slightly more limited. So how do you go about putting those guardrails in so people don't just like overrun capacity or spend all of their budget in 2 days?
Capacity is an interesting one, and sometimes you can manage that with various tools to allow projects to, you know, maybe you allocate a project a certain amount of resources and give them guardrails and they can consume what's in those resources. If they want to have more, they might request to be able to do more. So you could have, you know, some sort of guardrail, whether it's per project or business unit. Sometimes I've seen customers where they've backed their capacity management off where they get an alert saying, hey, it's time to buy something new because you're at, might have been at 80% capacity. And I've had a customer where they've backed that off to 70% just to allow more burst capacity. And then also looking at things like provisioned versus used capacity more seriously. So the provision takes a bit of a higher priority than what's used, especially at the start. A large part of it, though, is, you know, there's usually at least a 6-month curve. You're going to generally have an initial burst of, hey, cool, we can do this. This is great. Oh, yeah, okay. It's not so interesting after a few months, and then the capacity used might drop down or it might stay there. So there is a bit of trial and error and a bit of just, well, yeah, a lot of it is kind of trial and error. You're probably not going to get it right for the first 12 months.
Well, so why do I even bother with this then? I mean, I got public cloud will give me all the things and a lot more things with strange names in the AWS world specifically than I could possibly want or consume. So why am I bothering with private cloud, Brett?
The biggest one I've seen is usually access to legacy applications or internal data sets. So if you're trying to collect telemetry from 100,000 network devices across the country, which run your core network, it's not exactly easy to do from a service provider to get all that information up to a public cloud. And if you've got things like your Direct Connects and whatever other name vendors call it, that's a big one. And I was sort of surprised. I was seeing that more of a reason to work with than the more commonly spoken about ones such as data security or trusting third-party platforms. And sometimes it is just as simple as customers want to maintain control of their infrastructure, whether they're better or not at managing it than your cloud providers. It doesn't really matter too much. They like to have control. It's like, why can't we all have self-driving cars? I kind of like to have control of my own car sometimes.
Yeah, the security question was an interesting one too, because that was a big thing you heard not that many years ago, and you hear about it less, and it really feels like the public cloud providers have nailed down the security thing, so that's less of an argument, I think, now.
Yeah, I'd agree. As we see things more with government-specific services or the ISO, is it 27001? So whatever security standard is,
yeah,
you see that more, and people are becoming more trusting, or they're becoming more trusting of just, oh yep, we've got encrypted tunnels, and yeah, it does become a bit less of a concern. It seems to be more around how do I access the things, how do other people access? Like if I'm collecting data just using that network service, the network device as an example, I've collected the data. How do other people use it? And well, we already have central compute data centers. We've already got all the network plumbed for it, so we'll put it on-prem and then they can access it in the same way. And then it's kind of like data gravity away from the cloud in a way.
Yeah, interesting. So yeah, you're generating the data and collecting it, and you already have the sunk costs of your data centers. So why not modernize those and make them more usable as opposed to trying to push everything up into the cloud and then having some legacy system like pull it back down for analysis?
Yep.
I thought it was interesting that you mentioned data sovereignty and then kind of said, well, that's not really what I see. Because when I look at the marketing materials, it's like security and data sovereignty are like the two number one reasons why private cloud. But for you, it was more about this data gravity thing. Why do you think the data sovereignty thing is not as important now?
I guess it could be partly the customers that I've worked on. So this is sort of about my experience with it. I have worked on one where they, you know, did have sets of data which couldn't go external. However, at the same time, they did say that the cloud provider did, you know, have assurances on certain storage platforms that it wouldn't go external.
Mm.
So it does sound like they are trusting. There is a bit of trust there in the cloud providers when they say, no, we're not going to ship this to be external, or where they offer services such as Azure's Cosmos DB. Last time I remember it, that data will be, you know, at least if you're in Australia, that data is going to go to the States. So they are investigating those things, and they are also working with the cloud providers to get tick boxes checked to say, if I use this storage or this database, it is or is not going to leave the country. So I think there's quite a bit of trust in the providers, and when they get them to sign those, you know, forms saying this is what will happen, that they're taking it pretty seriously.
Yeah, it does seem like as the public cloud providers have grown, they have more regions now, so they can sort of guarantee that your data is going to stay in one place but still be redundant enough to meet the other SLAs that they've given. Now, you mentioned Cosmos DB, and that's a pretty cool feature offering that Azure has, and I know Google's got their big table and AWS has, and I forget what theirs called, it's something else esoteric. How do you convince the internal business units to use your private cloud when they see all these shiny toys out on the public cloud providers?
A lot of it's, there's a couple of ways that I've seen that. One is the business has said, you can't do it. Simple as that. And it has been a legitimate reason, as the business has said that, no, you can't use private cloud for this. Sometimes it is a bit of nostalgia of it's what they know. They know where it is. They, you know, might be able to throw a pie and hit one of the infrastructure teams when it's not working. If someone did that, that'd be great. I'd get fed while troubleshooting. And there's controls and there's things that they're just used to. And I think that's a big part of it, followed by the business saying, you can't use this service. And then again, we come back to where the data is and how to access the data. And sometimes they just don't even know where it is at times. But they just say, yep, we have a service. Ideally, in the purest definition of a service definition, they should have a service. Where it is shouldn't matter, but I mean, it does. But yeah, they often their concern is just, is it working?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you have to drive from the top down that, okay, team, it's time to use the internal private cloud that we built because, you know, whatever those reasons are, as opposed to if we build it, they will come?
I think it's a little bit of they want a cloud service, but they're not allowed to use a public cloud. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, they'll go, okay, well, we've built it. Oh, well, it's the only one we can go. You know, it's like saying, why do you buy a Volvo? Well, they're the only car on the market because all the others went bankrupt. It could be something like that. So yeah, that's generally the main reason why they've done that. I have seen a couple of cases where they did do it to prevent movement to other clouds. But again, that was similar because the business driver was from the top down of, well, we're going to put this in to stop them arguing that they don't have that capability available.
Okay, Brett, let's move along to some of the practical stuff. I want to build this thing, and there's a lot of moving parts in a private cloud. So we could start at the bottom, like with infrastructure and distributed computing and synchronizing databases and such, but let's go the other way. Let's start from the kind of the top down and talk about service catalogs. So if I want to start there, designing a service catalog, what can you tell us? Maybe we got a story with some challenges that you could share.
Yeah, the fun part of a service catalog is when people try to build a service without a service catalog and they've already spent $2 million on hardware and then you kind of try to actually define a service with what's already there, which is what I had, and then they haven't spoken to the consumers. And it seems to be a way where they've, you know, they're like, yep, we're going to put this in. Oh, now we're going to make it self-service or make it cloud, and they're trying to build on top of what they've already got. I'm not saying this has to be greenfield, but the idea of defining a service needs to be the first thing. And like any service, if you think of this more of a product, you're now a private cloud provider. You're not just an infrastructure team. What would you do if you're running this as a business? You'd talk to potential consumers or the existing consumers you have. What do you need? How do you do it? And there's battles that, not so much battles, it's probably the wrong term, but there's mindsets that you've got to work through. For example, if application teams are deploying and they're taking all the specs that they need from the vendor, and I've seen vendors say that you need a Intel Haswell, 4 cores at 2.43 gigahertz per core, you need this. And that doesn't work for cloud. And even though they have 3.2 gigahertz sockets, it didn't match the vendor spec. So there's those things as well, which are only really resolved by working with the customer and not just, or the internal consumer, and not just saying, well, no, you're wrong, but being, dare I say it, nice to them.
No.
Well, you're making a point here that it's not about the hardware and the cloud that all we infrastructure nerds think about. It's not servers and spinning drives and memory and CPU. It's about you're going to deliver a service on this thing. So what does that service look like? And then building the requirements from that, as opposed to, hey, we built a thing, I guess we can light up some services now.
From the services, there's, it's a lot like, I guess, building a product. What do they want? What is useful to them? Are you actually offering what is useful to them, but they don't under, you're, the way you're saying it is one way and the way they're saying it is another way? Like if you get a hardcore storage person trying to talk to a hardcore network person, they're trying to say the same thing of how storage should be available on the network, but it's just a bit off. And sometimes it's working through that where you define those products with the customer to say, well, yeah, this one actually does meet what you need. And then even then implementing things like, okay, well, if we've got a new need, let's have a, you know, whether it's a ticket, whether it's whatever, some sort of expression of interest register. So if you're starting to need higher performance storage, how does that go? Or having conversations with teams so you know about upcoming projects, because, you know, I've seen application teams go, huh, this new project's here, and they need, they're saying they need 100 gig bandwidth because that's what the vendor said. But we've only got 10 gig next. And trying to build from those conversations with the consumer so you know things are coming. So if there is a service where they need a high performance storage, maybe one of your SLAs in this is you're going to offer storage at, you know, 1 millisecond latency at 10,000 IOPS. If you offer that and you don't have that capability, assuming that you actually know the capability you have in the first place, then you've got time to actually implement that into your service and essentially kind of turn it into a radio button of, I want higher performance storage, and off we go. But if you don't have a way to register it, and you don't have a perhaps a monthly meeting with the teams to say, what do you have coming, what do you potentially have coming, so you might know how to alter to be able to offer that then as your service.
You know, I think about the way that Microsoft or AWS, they have like cloud evangelists, or they don't call them evangelists anymore, they call them something else now. But they have these people that go in, and basically their job is to talk to customers and find out what those customers are looking for and help them architect a solution with the bits that exist, or tell, go back to, you know, whoever, home base, and say, we need to build this thing because I've heard from 12 different customers that we need to have faster IOPS or a better Kubernetes deployment. Are you advocating the same sort of approach internally?
Definitely. There needs to be some way to check with other departments and I guess communicate more. I think traditionally communication between infrastructure and the teams consuming the infrastructure is pretty damn awful. But yeah, having that so you know if you're managing this that it's coming, and then as you touched on, they know that you may already have that capability, and that capability is ticking a box. But they also then know what they're in for as well, and have that relationship. You kind of, well, you already are, even if you're not doing cloud, but it's sort of rethinking what you're already doing in terms of you've got a self-service portal in front of it, but it's rethinking it to be a product.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably the most important takeaway so far. It's you're building it's a product. It's an internal product, but it's still a product that someone needs to consume. So all the steps that you go through developing a product, you kind of have to do this for the private cloud.
And market it.
And market it. Okay, well, we're going to have to touch back on that. I was going to ask you about SLAs, because you mentioned SLAs, and I know what that means in the context of like a public cloud where they say I get X amount of bandwidth and X number of IOPS. Is there something more nuanced or different about SLAs internally? And how do you even determine what a reasonable SLA is for your service?
SLAs are really, really difficult. Sometimes they can be, some of them are a bit simpler, such as overcommitment. For example, we might say that we're not going to overcommit CPU more than 3:1. And again, to a lot of apps teams, that you could say that, and that's a pretty low ratio. But some app teams are like, oh, it's not guaranteed. And even though there is no contention, it's a problem. And I still haven't seen good examples when it comes to storage of determining SLAs. They kind of just say, yeah, we're going to give you, you know, X gigabytes, or you're going to, you know, you, that's it. They don't, I haven't seen good examples still of, you know, actual testing. We're putting in this storage platform and we're going to test it, see what it does. So then we can define an SLA around that. Or availability, they usually take it from the vendor. You know, you put in our, we'll say it's an external SAN, and because you've configured it this way, our documentation from the vendor says that's 3 nines. So we'll give you 3 nines.
I was going to say like 1 9, not 90 either, just 9. That's what I'm guaranteeing.
You get 9.
Well, when you deal with SLAs internally, though, Brett, I mean, like a big service provider, they have a system that's built around metrics and measurements and being able to demonstrate via statistics how a service was delivered, which is a whole, if you're trying to do that internally, that's actually really hard.
It is. And because internally is constantly changing, and because internally in has often been a lot of, we've put hardware in because we needed it right now. I mean, right now could be 6 months ago because we, the servers we could get only had DC power and we only run AC in our data center, and now we need, you know, to deal with that, which actually, sorry, in my experience, that was 9 months, not 6 months. It's so, I hate the term and I really, really cringe when I hear it, but it grows organically internally to start with, that if you don't do a greenfield, getting SLAs, especially around storage, seems to be one of the hardest, is really difficult. And to do that, because you can't really, you know, test the performance and latency of a storage that everyone's doing it, because you've got to hammer that storage really hard. Network bandwidth, and over subscription of things such as compute, like a CPU and memory, yeah, that seems to be a bit, you know, a bit easier. But yeah, just especially on the storage front, it's sometimes I think they just not put it into the service, just say we're going to, you know, you're going to have this amount of storage and keep it as that. And then if they want to offer it later on, it could be that, well, we'll put this in as a new storage platform so we know it from the start, especially depending on how rigorous some business units might be to, well, you said you'd offer this and it's, you know, I'm getting 1.5 milliseconds latency. That's unacceptable.
I guess I feel like we're getting hung up on SLAs a little bit. So if I look at creating a service, then SLAs would be one component of that service. What other things could we include in that?
So the service could be what options are available. Is backup going to be a part of this? Does your backup solution offer the ability to have a, you know, whether it's API or its own web front end, so people could choose their own backup options, or you could at least on the form configure a backup policy, you know, none, bronze, silver, gold. And so you can add those sorts of things to the service. And the more you add, though, the harder it is to manage. So you've also then got to consider, well, what can my team actually manage? Mm-hmm. You know, should we offer backup as a service from day one while we're trying to learn this? Or should we just continue saying, if these VMs, if we're just talking VMs, are just going to be backed up. And that's it. We're just going to say they're going to be backed up. And then later on, when we're comfortable with what we got, we could build our service because, hey, look, that's an expression of interest. So, yeah, around the defining of the service, there's a lot around that. There's approval policies. If you look at capacity management, perhaps you might offer small, medium, large, extra large. But if you order more, if you order an extra large, maybe it just does need a manual approval. So, you know, it to help prevent running out of space. And manual approvals aren't very cloudy. Is that a word? Oh, it'll make half the people cry. But again, it could just be a reality.
Yeah, I know in the past when I would use a public cloud service, they have limitations on how much of a particular resource you can create. You know, if I try to make 3 gargantuan virtual machines, I might only be approved for 2 in my account, and I have to put in a ticket and explain why I need 3 or 5. And I guess this is just another instance of that, where if you're going to consume a really big resource, you need a justification for doing that.
For sure.
When you're coming up with a sizing strategy, because, I mean, I guess one of the good things about private cloud is you have if you're the consumer, you kind of have direct access to the person who is providing that service. So you can, you know, ask them to tweak things or make manual changes, even though they probably shouldn't. Like when you're talking to the faceless big clouds, you can tell them whatever you want, but they're just going to give you the same service. It's like you get three sizes and that's it. How do you come up with a good sizing strategy, and how do you stick to it when the person comes up and is like, hey, but I really just need, I need like another gig of RAM. Come on, can't you just, between friends?
Hey man, hey, you got any more of them RAMs? I guess it kind of depends. If someone's going to be running, say, Chrome and Slack together on one of their VMs, yeah, you're going to need a lot of RAM. Where I've worked before is I've used analysis tools to look at the amount that's actually consumed, because if we look at the amount that's provisioned, your large size, if you just look at three sizes, is going to be massive and it's barely going to be used and everyone's always going to select that. So I sort of work on looking at kind of a bit like a bell graph of, you know, smalls, what's being consumed, and, you know, it's down the lower end of the bell graph. So if you had that, you know, sort of where it starts to taper up, sort of around there is the small, where it's going to fit all the use cases. The medium's at top of the bell graph, and then the large is sort of the mirror opposite to the small of that size. If, and hopefully the business does it, if they have some sort of chargeback or showback, you can incentivize people picking the small or the medium just through costing. You could have, say, small and medium, they might be $10 a month per CPU core. Your large could be $30 or $40 per month per CPU core. And it can help incentivize for them then to up it if they need it later.
Or de-incentivize overutilization. Because as engineers, we're going to default to the biggest, baddest thing we think we can afford, even if we think we're only going to use 10%, because you never know. That day might come where we need so much more and we'll be glad we had it, even though we're never actually going to need it. So your point was that pricing, right? You make it, you just put them in this box like, listen, you're going to have to get someone to bless this thing if you really think you need something that huge. You really need a small or a medium, not a large.
Yep. And you can also incentivize downsizing. This depends on the maturity and how much you can manage. If you can allocate or tag that, say, VM or that service consumption to a business unit, you can report to them that they're using too much and they could save money if they downsized it, because they're using within that range. And if they're using an OPEX billing model, that does work. I've worked with a couple of places where they're fully CapEx and it's just a nightmare, and they've got more money than they need. So it just gets really, really oversubscribed very quickly. So there can be that way as well. So the report might, instead of going to the engineers to go, well, just in case, you know, we've got to reduce risk, it could actually go to the line managers or business unit managers and say, huh, we could save 45% and we're well within parameters. You know, we may just make it really simple. If you have, here's a line with how much you have, and a third of the way down the line is you're using this. You could save so much per month on this. And give them visibility. But again, this is one of those maturity things of how much can you handle. You're building this from the start. You've got a lot of work already that you're not used to doing, talking to other teams, finding services. Now we're building customer reports to help this. But you may also have those just internal. I believe it was AWS had one of their frugal, I think it's one of their values was like frugality. And they would have people go to customers and say, hey, look, you could save so much percent by doing this another way, whether it's consuming a different service or just using, you know, correcting the size of the EC2 instances you're using, and having that ability there to help with your capacity management. Because the less oversized it is, the less at risk you are from burst.
So it sounds like there's just a lot of moving parts here. There's the service itself. There's the underlying infrastructure that needs to support that service. There's the capacity that you have to get right, or at least the t-shirt sizes you're offering to the customer. And then you need to be able to monitor it and bill it back and maybe offer some additional services like backup as a service. that's just a lot going on for one place to build. And it sounds like you're saying, don't do it all once. Like, you need to chunk this out. So if you were planning out someone's roadmap for rolling out a private cloud, where would you start and kind of what would the general stages be to reach that level of maturity?
So thankfully, like, there are some vendors that offer a bit of more of a turnkey, which covers a bit of it. It's never all of it, especially the business side. That can make the on-ramping easier compared to maybe building a custom offering through OpenStack where you've just done a Git clone and you're working through that. So that's one way to sort of at least get a blank canvas going. From the starting point, if the business is doing it as early as possible, if the business is driving it as early as possible, start talking to who you're expecting to consume it. These are probably going to be the people who are already consuming what you've got. Look at, try to get visibility of upcoming projects so you know what to cater for. You might just have a directive that we want to do private cloud at this stage, which is hopefully where you're at, not here's existing tin, make it fit all the new use cases. And security is around, network security is always a big one, and this is a big scare for a lot, not so much scare, concern to be a better term, for the teams in terms of if we give them more control, what will happen? So defining more policies. So a lot of this is boring process and policy stuff to start with, but this is where they do need to start. Who's going to maintain border control and what does that look like? So cloud providers, is if I go to a cloud provider, I can just open up border to whatever I want in. Doesn't quite work the same for internal. There's some border control. So understand those things that calm the fears to start with. So understand what people want, how much they want, or how much they're likely to want, and then calm the fears that are coming up. They're probably the very, very first places, and we haven't even defined us, we haven't really put this into any sort of service definition. Mm-hmm. Then we can take that, we can put that into some sort of service definition, which says we're going to offer it, and it's going to look roughly like this. Then take that back to the consumers and just say, this is what it looks like, and define that sort of as a minimum viable product. This lets you, could just be, deploy a VM. Now, you could be potentially at the time, though, you could be running the latest version of your backup platform that has a very simple integration to your self-service portal where you've already got your backup policies, where it could be a two-minute job to add that in. Actually, we'll be more realistic, maybe 2 days. So you may actually put that in there, but if it's not, you've got to consider that. So what do you currently have? But you've got to make sure it's manageable. The less you do at the start while people are learning it, the more manageable it is. And then just build from there. And then you'll know what your services are. That will tell you what hardware you need. It may tell you that maybe your preferred vendor covers most of it. It will help you understand, though, whether you need to look for another vendor or just simply that no vendor really offers it. And then are you offering something too bespoke, or do you just need to write a little bit of code or some custom workflows to make that, to finish that off?
Too bespoke. Let's go with something simple, Brett, to start with. Infrastructure as a service, baby. It's got to be easy, right? Or is it? Is it just offering up VMs on demand, or would there be more involved if I want to offer up my own IaaS service?
VMs on demand is, it can be hard because of business policy. And especially billing is the thing that's really kicked my butt many times, and I've had many arguments about billing. In the same way, though, offering a Kubernetes service hasn't really been harder. Like, offering Kubernetes as a platform as a service hasn't been harder than offering VMs as a service. It's still all those same things of, for Kubernetes, are you going to let them have their own cluster, or are you going to have a shared cluster and namespaces? I'm working on a project, or I've worked on a project for a customer where they didn't want one application team to be able to talk to another application team's pods. So when we looked at it, they didn't want to limit the application team's cadence. So if they're working on something, they need to open a network policy in Kubernetes, they wanted to just be able to do it. So we couldn't just say, oh, cool, we'll set a network policy within Kubernetes that says these can't happen within the same Kubernetes cluster. So then that drove the decision to say one cluster per application team. And then they could define that. It wasn't, the consideration was a bit different, but then again, that's not much different there to say, well, we want people to be able to control their OS firewalls or perhaps distributed firewalls if they've got an SDN. And how do we stop one talking to the other? Well, we're going to give them their own network each time. You know, so the considerations are similar, and I wouldn't really say they're harder.
Everything's about policy in this conversation, though, which is interesting. In other words, it's not about how difficult the technology is or isn't. There's 4, 5, 6, 10 different ways that you could do this, whatever the service is. But it's all about scoping, looking at what you've got, dealing with budget, the same decisions we're always making. Brett, where's the magic? Come on.
Well, for a daily fee, I could tell you the magic. there is really no magic behind it. It's more policy, I think, than what they're currently used to, because the policy has to be better defined than it goes to an infrastructure team. It's easier to tell when something goes against the policy because it's more clearly defined. So you can't necessarily just go to your favorite infrastructure person with a coffee and say, hey, do you mind just, you know, putting this on the whitelist for me? Thanks. And, it's a funny thing. Like it's all cloud and it's all meant to be new and exciting. And as engineers, we're still really good at overcomplicating the hell out of everything. But at the end of the day, it's like offering anything new. You've just got to start with what you can manage and work within the policies that you're given.
I think there might be some concern when it comes to implementing your private cloud, especially if you're doing a lot of bespoke and very customized type things, that you're building a mountain of technical debt that you're never going to dig yourself out of. But there's also like off-the-shelf solutions that offer private cloud to a certain degree. So how do you balance that between, I need a certain amount of customization, but I don't want to die under the mountain of tech debt I've created, but I need something more than just what's straight off the shelf?
So I guess for disclosure, I work for a vendor and I do work very heavily on a product that does exactly that second one of, it offers sort of private cloud services with the ability to bespoke it. So if my terminology or anything's skewed, just going to put that out there now. So in terms of, do you want to do it all yourself manually? Probably not, unless you've got a very mature, reasonably sized infrastructure team. We've seen this at other companies in the past, OpenStack being a prime example of a technology stack that customers have put in, and they've tried to do it all themselves. And they had a lot of trouble. So vendors started, you know, offering OpenStack solutions, which had some nice web front end to put a wrapper around it. We see that, you know, we've seen the same thing with Kubernetes. You could deploy it vanilla and then write your own custom work for it, but it gets hard to manage, and you need to, just like any developer process, there needs to be a maturity to prevent that technical debt. But as we've also seen, though, any vendor product has always got technical debt. You go, well, why do you have this here? And it's like, well, yeah, sorry about that. yeah, we wrote that 10 years ago, and it was just meant to be there to fix it, but it's become core of our system. Yeah. So when evaluating, yes, writing it from scratch yourself is, you know, yeah, it's very, very flexible. But then again, so is doing Linux from scratch. Not many people really want to do Linux from scratch. Going to taking something that's off the shelf that does most of it is usually a pretty good idea. Again, my opinion might be skewed there. But you also need to understand the limitations of where that sits. Does it do? So before, like any design process in the fictional world, you work out all your requirements and everything you need before you choose a product, where in the real world, the product's usually chosen, then you've got to make it fit with a sledgehammer. So, yeah, it's really about, what does it offer? Cool, it offers most of what we want, and we just need to write a few things in an orchestration system, which, hey, look, it comes with, and you know, we're good. Or is it, well, we're trying to do something really bespoke and nothing really fits. Well, I guess my first question then is, what the hell are you trying to do and why are you trying to do it that way? And I'm not saying there's not a good reason. It's just what I would ask. Mm-hmm. So, and then, of course, can you manage that?
Right. Right. There's going to be that administrative overhead that you're already trying to run a private cloud. Do you really want all this additional overhead of running a highly customized private cloud as well?
How special of a snowflake do you think you are? Really? Come on.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, talk to us about security, Brett. So, you know, in the public cloud, of course, all the security is there, but you got to know how to actually use it and implement it. And then that's a difficult thing. Do we have the same kind of challenges in private cloud? You know, if you get too crazy with the security, then it gets hard for your customers to actually consume the cloud because it's too darn secure. Or I guess, is there such a thing as too secure? I don't know. Anyway, what are your comments here, Brett?
Yeah, security is an interesting one because I've found that infrastructure teams are hesitant or concerned to give the application teams what they need. But one of the problems that application teams have and why they look at cloud offerings is so they can configure it to meet what they need. Where it comes to public cloud is they don't do too much to prevent an application team to say, oh, yep, everything can come into my app on every port. Yeah, just open it up to the world. Generally, internally, how would we put that? Frowned upon?
Yes.
So to help that, there's got to be a balance. What I've generally seen that works okay is that the infrastructure team maintains a border, some sort of border security. Now, this could be data center border. This could be if each team has their own network. So like, in Amazon, a bit like a VPC, they may maintain that border. Mm. And those rules to that border could be actually fairly hard to change. Within that area, though, they could give the application team all the access that they want. So you could deploy VMs and by default, they can't talk to anything because you're putting the application there, whether it's one you've developed yourself or one from a vendor. You could then, you know, use a form or as part of the deployment, say, open these firewall rules between this VM and this VM, so between app and DB or something, and go from there. You could have another form, and this could be a manually approved one that says, well, our app is, you know, going to be accessible from other areas of the business on these ports. So then it could be manually approved to open that at your border and configure other borders if required. And I've seen that balance, and that worked all right. It was a bit of work to put in, but it struck a good balance. It wasn't frictionless. And in the reality, sometimes things aren't going to be frictionless, but the app team did like that they could configure the internal firewalls themselves. So they weren't always the fan of the pretty much block any by default, but when they knew the ports from working with the vendor, they could open it up as required. Request to open it at the border to allow external access in or out beyond the default. Now, I think it had about a 2-hour turnaround. It was roughly by the time they got to it, they looked at it and they were okay. And, you know, that was still better than what they had, where, you know, network teams had to deal with a lot of other requests and everything else. So, you know, it was a bit of a compromise. And like I said, it wasn't fully frictionless, but it maintained that control that the infrastructure team wanted or needed, depending mm-hmm. on your view. It did give the developers a lot of freedom within or even just the application teams managing a off-the-shelf application. It gave them the freedom to configure as they required without putting in a heap of requests like those, you know, 75-line firewall spreadsheets you got to send to the network team just when you want to deploy a new application. And then they say to you, okay, well, what's the IP address it's coming from? And you say, well, I don't know because I haven't deployed the VM yet. I say, why haven't you deployed the VM yet? Because I haven't had my firewall rules approved. Yes, I'm looking at you, Ethan.
And
then I'm going to ask you, well, what are all the ports? I don't know where all the ports are. What do you mean you don't know where all the ports are? Well, they're ports. Can't you just open all of them? Okay, this conversation many times.
So here's the link to the public documentation. Work it out.
Yeah, work it out. And the public documentation says, you need to open up 51,124 to 6,000. Oh, just stop. Yep. And they're always out of date. And yeah. Mm. Yep. It's good times.
Well, as we start to wrap up the episode, I think, Brett, you have some key takeaways for anybody who's considering getting into this wild and crazy world of private cloud. So what would those sort of key takeaways be?
I guess the key takeaways is look at defining the service and understanding the policies you're going to need. Some policies may exist, some may need to be worked out. So look at that. What can you offer? What do you need to offer? Sometimes what's wanted, you may not be able to manage at the start, and you need to have good communications with your consumers to let them understand that they may want something that you simply don't have the capacity to manage or implement at this point in time, and let them know, have a roadmap. Treat it like a product. You've got consumers, you've always had consumers, and you've always had angry phone calls from consumers when things don't work. This is no different. This is no different to if I go to, get my car serviced and I get poor service from the mechanics. Same thing on the consumer. If it doesn't work the way I wanted it to, I'm going to complain, and that's a service. So, but you just need to now start thinking of it like a service and like a product. And I guess, start small. You may have a lot of things in the business that don't fit, and it could simply be that they don't fit. We're not going to do them. You want to do chargeback on a upfront CapEx model? Yeah, okay. It's not going to fit very well, and it's going to look really, it's going to become really inaccurate when you try to work out what things actually cost you, but sure. And that can be one of those things of it can work, but it shouldn't. And you've got to have that conversation. And as engineers, we also, when we know we're right, we like to only be right. But sometimes also as engineers, we need to say, yeah, look, it's not going to work, but I've told you, I've put it in, and yeah. So yeah, they're sort of my key takeaways there.
Gotcha. All right.
None of them really technical.
No, and it sounds like a lot of the early portions of planning are not technical in nature. You got to nail down some of this other stuff before you start ordering hardware. So it makes sense to me. All right, Brett, if people want to follow you, hear more of your useful insights, do you have a blog? Do you have Twitter? Where can people find you?
Yeah, so I blog at sdbrett.com. So sierradeltabrett.com or Software Defined Brett for the initials at the front there. And I'm on Twitter at BrettJohnson008.
Awesome. Well, Brett Johnson, thank you so much for being a guest today on Day 2 Cloud.
Thank you very much.
And you. Hey, you. Yeah, you out there listening. Virtual high fives to you for tuning in. You did great. If you have suggestions for future shows, we'd love to hear them. You can hit either of us up on Twitter. I'm at Ned1313, or you can help Ethan on at EC Banks, or you can fill out the form on my fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. If you've got a way cool cloud product that you want to share with our audience of IT professionals, you could become a Day 2 Cloud sponsor. You'll be super shiny for doing it. You're going to reach several thousand listeners, all of whom have problems to solve. Maybe your product fixes their problem, but you know what? They're never going to know unless you tell them about your amazing cloudy solution. So you can find out more if you go to packetpushers.net/sponsorship. Until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.